This is the second in a series of interviews with persons in the Fairbanks area who had significant roles to play in the Fairbanks flood. Mr. Wally, would you identify yourself and describe your position?
Bill Wally, operations manager of KFAR Radio and TV, and Fairbanks City Councilman and Borough Assemblyman.
Could you give us an idea of when you first, say, became aware of a serious flood threat?
I don't think anybody was really aware of a serious flood threat until they had water in their homes in many cases. Even in the broadcast media, we, of course, were taking the Weather Bureau's forecast of a crest as late as 1 o'clock in the morning, Tuesday morning, and I think they were cresting at that time a little over 15 feet, and at that time we still thought that would be the crest, and we were figured that that would be all over in about a half hour or so, and then, of course, it kept coming, and each inch of the river going up meant a little more flooding. And after a while, we played it by ear, an inch at a time.
Could you, say, start sketching out your activities of Monday with reference to the flood and your activities in response to the initial threat of the flood, then?
Flood coverage actually started for me on Sunday. It was Sunday night that I went out to the Salcher River to cover the breakthrough on the Richardson Highway and went out there not believing that I was going to see all the water that I saw. As a matter of fact, I thought it was going to be sort of a Sunday jaunt on the way out that evening, so I even took my wife and children with me and went along with Councilman John Huber to check out the water out there because we'd had reports that it was quite high. We got out there and found out that it was rather a fantastic sight, even terrifying, because the water was swishing over the Richardson Highway on the other side of the bridge, the new bridge, and was creating waterfalls, and it was really a terrifying sight. We then were practically cut off at the Aurora Lodge because one of the bridges on the other side of the Aurora Lodge had washed away partially, and I had to take my children on my back that night and carry them over the partially washed out bridge to get back to an automobile that was on the other side so that we could get back in town. We had the feeling when we got back in town that Sunday night that we were getting away from the water, and it was a large feeling of relief. At 3 o'clock Monday morning, we were called on the Nanana situation and had to come to work 3 o'clock Monday morning to help out with the civil offense here. We're the civil offense station here locally. And we stayed on the air from 3 o'clock in the morning until about 10 in the morning here on the board at KFAR, giving out evacuation notices to Island Homes and some of the other areas that were evacuated earlier on Monday. And then we went out in one of the remote cars and spent the entire day just driving around the area, still with the feeling that we were going to have a little water, but nothing, you know, as far as the entire city was concerned. We continued to do that until our television program that Monday night, and did a flood special that night talking about the water. At that time, the Big 30 that I'm on, of course, is on at 6 p.m. in the evening. At that time, we had a camera on top of the roof, and at that time, the water was just up to the bottom of the Cushman Street Bridge, and we really didn't believe, as everybody else really didn't believe, that the water was going to go much higher than that at that time. As a matter of fact, in my own personal life, in between remotes, I live on Hilton, and I dropped by the house just before I went home to do the TV show. That was about 5 o'clock or 4:30, around in there somewhere, and there was no water in sight around my area, Hilton and Weeksfield, at all, and we were kidding and joking that the water might come down Hilton, and saying it only as a joke, my wife and I, you know, well, the water is going to come down Hilton. And my wife didn't take it too much as a joke, primarily because she'd been out to the Salcher with me that night, and it had scared her, and she'd seen what that water can do, and so she was, at that early in the afternoon, was packing her clothes, just in case. When I came back after the TV show, of course, we had water on Hilton, not very much, an inch or two. And at that time, she had decided that she was going to catch a plane to Seattle. And a little later on in the evening, she did that. I went back out on the remotes until she had time to pack about 8 o'clock, went back and picked her up, and then called into the station, said I was going to do a two-fold thing. I was going out and check the airport road as far as water was concerned and put my wife in the airplane at the same time. At that time, one of the people in the remote cars made the statement, "Wee Willie, you're just trying to give your wife a vacation." You know, it's sort of silly to send her out on the plane that night. And at that time, we really didn't think that there was any need for her to leave on the plane, but I figured, well, I'll get some water in the basement maybe, you know, and as everybody was getting, and it'd be such a mess that I might as well get rid of the kids and the wife at that time, not really believing we'd have any water up to the house at that time. Put her on the plane for a completely different reason than the people who went on the planes the next day and so on and so forth. I went right back down to the downtown area. By the way, by the time I put her on the plane at the airport, the water had risen considerably on Airport Road, and I had a hard time getting back downtown. I pulled in on my street, Hilton, and I couldn't get in there, and of course I had driven out just an hour and a half before, but I couldn't get back in. So then I decided to go towards KFAR, which is on 2nd Avenue, which, by the way, didn't have any water at that time on 2nd Avenue. Water had crept into the back and hadn't been hadn't hit 2nd Avenue yet. But I went down Cowles, and there was no water there at all. It was perfectly dry. I turned right on 7th Avenue and ran into a wall of water around the Civil Defense Building, trying to get to Civil Defense first, then to get a pass and move on down to KFAR. And I also thought that the city councilmen were probably called. We hadn't had any word yet, but I thought they'd probably been called, and they would be meeting in the Civil Defense Building. But I couldn't get to the Civil Defense Building. Did a little waiting, trying to get over there. I couldn't get over there even waiting. So I went back to my car, and at that time, of course, all of the radio personnel of KFAR had been in contact with me through the remote controls, and our general manager, Don Anden, was stationed right downtown and found himself blocked in on the downtown area. He couldn't drive out. I couldn't drive in, and he couldn't drive out. So we kept in complete contact during the entire evening up till this time. This was about midnight. You want me to stop and
No, I just wanted to get the time, see if you can keep
this,
interjecting.
Well, the times
time.
Are going to be difficult,
right?
Because we weren't asking each other what time it was. We got a little excited at times. Most of the broadcast personnel stayed so very calm that it was unbelievable. But, of course, when you have water scooting around the windows of your car, you know, you get a little excited. Mr. Anden, downtown, told us it must have been about 11 o'clock, because the plane leaves at 10:30, come to think about it. And it was about a half hour later, and I found I couldn't get downtown. And I could hear the boys around in the remote units, and they were telling me where they were at, and they were saying, well, we're having a difficult time getting here and a difficult time getting there. But there's one place that was still high that I had noticed coming back from the airport, and that was the Chevron station on Airport Road, right across the street from the Tiny's Pancake House. So seeing that Don Anden was sort of stuck downtown, couldn't get his car out, and all the other announcers were in a ring sort of around the city, I asked that we all meet at that Chevron station because it seemed to me we could all get there. And we did, and all the boys showed up there. We were discussing how we were going to situate ourselves, still now, at this point, not really thinking that we're going to have a lot of water, that the water is just about done with, but at least trying to get our broadcast facilities put together so that we could continually cover the people that had a lot of water, like Hamilton Acres and things of this nature. Then we heard over the radio, Mr. Anden said the water is now on 2nd Avenue, and it's pouring into the basement of the Lathrop Building where our power was at. So we knew right away that we had to figure a different way to broadcast rather than from this building. So Don made a real short comment. Of course, we were all pretty tired, and a lot of us had been broadcasting, as you have to remember, from the Sunday night before. And he made the comment, well, fellas, it looks like the transmitter is our only hope. But we have a transmitter on Farmers Loop Road, and it, of course, was high and dry. We broadcast usually by remote control from that transmitter, and the power was fast fading in the Lathrop Building about that time. So we started making quick assignments. Don, of course, had a rather unusual thing happen about that time. His wife was about ready to have a baby, so he had to leave us for a moment or two and take care of that problem. Then we made some physical announcer assignments. My car was already sputtering and spewing and wouldn't run anymore, so we decided to leave my car and go into teams. We had to, of course, stay into cars that had radios. That was all important at that time. As a matter of fact, those remote facilities and those cars became probably the most important thing we had a little later on in the night. So myself and Jerry Springer, I assigned the two of us to go to the transmitter, and we'd heard it was difficult to get there over University Avenue, and it was, we found out later. But and I put Lee and Bobby Parsons together in a remote car, and we knew that Don Anden would be back on 2nd Avenue in a matter of moments. So off we went. Lee and Bob headed for the downtown area to get as close as they could, And Jerry and I headed for the KFAR transmitter. It was just at this time that something happened to Jerry's radio unit, so he lost contact for a moment. At the same time, KFAR radio went off the air. We heard the announcer up here say, "The power's fading fast," and blowy, it went. That was when the water hit the transformers in the basement, evidently, or they turned it off before it, just inches before it did hit the transformer. So we were driving blind. We didn't really know how we stood. And by the way, when I was out at the airport, Don had issued an order for the engineers to go out to the transmitter. Only I didn't know that. And somebody, the other boys knew it, but they didn't tell me because they thought I knew it. So I was driving blind out there, too. I didn't know what was going to happen when we got there. If we'd have just had a transmitter there, we'd have been in trouble. Because personally, myself, and Jerry might have been able to do something, but I don't know if I could have got that thing on the air or not. But we were lucky. We had a terrifying ride, as many, many people did, across the University Bridge. The water was getting deeper there, and it was a pretty tough ride. We made it without too much trouble. When we got on Farmer's Loop, of course, it was like being shipwrecked and finding an island. And when we got to the transmitter, we were even more excited when we found that all of our engineering staff was there. At least our prime engineers were there, our chief engineer and our assistant chief, and several of our technicians had beat us out there and had gone out earlier in the evening when the transportation wasn't too difficult, and had rigged up an old generator that we had out there for civil defense purposes, but actually hadn't been tested in several years. Found that we didn't have enough gas to make it run very well. We were off the air, I think, approximately 10 minutes at that time. As a matter of fact, when we were going out to the university, we heard our chief engineer come on the air, and it was a real blessing. He said, "This is KFAR, now broadcasting from the transmitter." When we got there, we found one microphone. They hooked up one microphone. They didn't have any turntable facilities or anything like that, of course. We just had a microphone. And we, myself and Jerry, of course, went immediately on the air and started talking. We had a phone at the transmitter that was working for about an hour before it went out. GVA, of course, had lost power, and the generator was all the power that we had. The engineers' wives and their children were there. They had moved them up there for sanctuary, besides, of course, putting the equipment together. We had about 11 children who were sleeping there on the concrete floor a little later on. And the first couple of hours, of course, we just talked. As a matter of fact, it was 9 hours. If I remember correctly, Jerry and I just sat there and talked for 9 hours, taking 25 minutes on and 25 minutes. Well, actually, we didn't do that either. We just sort of talked and moved the microphone back and forth and talked until we were done. The engineers, in a couple of hours, had rigged up our radio remote by Jerry's car radio that went out with us, and we were in contact within an hour or so with the downtown units. And the way we first did that, we just used their speakers while they were frantically rigging up a complete radio station is what they were doing. It took them a day, but within a day we did have every facility there that we needed. But we got contact with Mr. Annan once again, who was located on 2nd Avenue. Mr. Russell, Lee Russell, was located on the bridge and stayed there until the water forced him off, of course. And Bobby Parsons was down there with the boys. They were the three main staff members who were downtown, and Jerry and I remained at the transmitter. And in about 9 hours, I think we had a turntable that we played some old 78s that we found in the attic out there for a while. And then people started from the hill up there, started bringing us lots of records to play from their personal stereo collections that we used for a while. Music, of course, was not important, but it helped to break the monotony of continuous emergency messages, which sometimes in themselves can create tension. When you have one after the other, this emergency, that emergency, this terrible thing happening, that terrible thing happening. And you have to keep the people informed, of course, and let them know what's going on. But the little music that we had there was a welcome relief at times. What else? Tell me what to say.
Okay, as I remember it, Monday and Tuesday, or Monday night and Tuesday, you kept mentioning that you were on emergency status. What, does this require something of you regarding FCC or anything like this?
Yeah, that was directly for the FCC, although I don't think under those circumstances they would have said much about it. The reason we did that is because we were giving so many personal messages. Of course, that's against an FCC regulation. As a matter of fact, all of our messages were direct personal messages. We became, rather than a broadcast station, we became a center just to tell people and deliver communications, and we became an emergency center, seeing that we were only the only link of communications that the general public had immediately when the helicopters started flying. They brought us radio links with the civil defense, with the mayor's office, and with the multitude of other emergency offices that were in effect. And we had communications link up with everybody within a matter of 12 or 13 hours. That's a long time, but it didn't seem like a long time when you were out there. We had radio communications with civil defense, and everybody started heading for the high ground in the first place. As you know, we had, I really don't know what the estimates were. At that time, we were estimating, including the 6,000 at the University of Alaska, about 14,000 to 15,000 people that were on that hill. Pretty soon, KFAR became sort of a hub and a center for everything, including the university. Dr. Wood came to us several times for communications and help in the evacuation of people to the university and in taking care of them once they got there. Civil defense, seeing that I was on the city council, the mayor and civil defense brought the Red Cross director from the Northwest District out to us, and we set up a Red Cross center there. We set up a hospital there at KFAR, a temporary hospital. Dr. Dealey ran that for us, and it became sort of a hub for, you know, it was a full week that we were out there. Go ahead.
In civil defense, what kind of communications did you have with the defense agency? Was it a constant thing, or was there, say, a gap of information between yourself and civil defense at all?
There were definite gaps of information, not only between us and civil defense, but between civil defense and other agencies and between the agencies themselves. You have to realize that most of civil defense and their related agencies are set up primarily for all types of general disasters, but flood, believe it or not, is the one disaster that they're probably less set up for. And I'll tell you why. Just for instance, most of the equipment is put away very safely against nuclear attack in basements, low spots around the area, and a lot of that equipment was hit immediately by the water. And of course, the water came so very rapidly after the 1 a.m. time Tuesday that many people, including those who were officials, didn't have time to get equipment out. I think the primary gap, as far as communications breakthrough were concerned, were when you're dealing with radios, sometimes it's difficult to understand exactly what the fella says on both ends. When hundreds of people are dealing with radios and you're communicating back and forth to several different agencies all at once, and you have different people who are trying to put together this communications, you can lose two or three words. And in the case of this kind, each and every individual word was important. I think this was a case where many, many people took on authority that they didn't have before the flood. Many people did. They just took the authority because at that time everybody was separated, if you recall. The water had left some people on the hill who should have been in town, some people in town who should have been on the hill. For instance, the City Public Works Department had several of their people and equipment stranded up at the university who had gone up there. They were in that area, had gone up there to keep their vehicles out of the water, to keep them running, then couldn't get back. I had several of them running myself for me and the Red Cross getting food to the people out in the hill. There was a definite shortage of food after a few days, as you remember. But I don't think there was any large communications breakdown. There were many, many small ones. And that's about all I can say in that.
I see. In talking about the relief agencies, when did Salvation Army first contact you? Do you have any idea?
I don't recall the exact time. They were the first that actually had food out at the university. The Red Cross was the first to contact us. The Red Cross and the Salvation Army are competitors to a certain extent. And it's very difficult to say if either one did a better job. Lo and behold for me to say whether one or the other did a better job. Both of them, I think, did a splendid job. There was a lag as far as action was concerned in those areas, too. But no larger lag than in any other organization. It's just a lot of water around, and you don't move too rapidly when there's that much water around, you know. It's just an impossibility.
Right, right. Say to get back to the more critical hours of late Monday night, Tuesday morning, What kind of, say, assistance did you feel you could be to people who were in areas that were likely to be affected immediately? Did you get any communications from civil defense saying that the water is likely to hit such and such a spot in Hamilton Acres? And
oh, yeah, that started early Monday morning even. We mm-hmm. evacuated Hamilton, not Hamilton Acres, but Island Homes. The evacuation order came out from civil defense, I think, about 8:30 in the morning. I may be an hour off at this point. But it was early in the morning that they started evacuating from civil defense Island Home. Some of the other areas may not have been evacuated in time because of communications breakdown. I mean physical communications breakdowns where we lost contact. In some areas, they couldn't evacuate them in time simply because the water came so fast and it was a completely unexpected thing. They're still studying that, of course. They don't know why. For instance, they had a foot and a half or so, at least the way the stories go from the people in that area, of water suddenly rush into Hamilton Acres. They don't know why that happened, as far as I understand, and they're still trying to find out why that happened. One of a dozen reasons, probably, a log jam break or who knows what. But they didn't expect to get the wall of water that they got. You know, most times the Chena River, and it has flooded in the past, is a slow-rising type thing, and they thought it was going to be that way this time. But it wasn't. As far as going up on the watershed and taking a look, they had people up there. They took a look, I understand, several people from one official from the Weather Bureau was up, but it was still difficult to determine from the flight in the air exactly how much water was going to come down on Fairbanks. Of course, the weather advisories, as far as the prediction of the crest, came from the Anchorage Weather Bureau, and right now I understand the state legislators in the special session are going to request that they move the job of forecasting rivers and weather for Fairbanks back to Fairbanks.
I see. To get back to your mobile units, how many did you have, and do you remember where each of them were placed during the flood?
Well, we started out with about five. Of course, we ended up with two or three. Don Anden's personal car with the unit in it, of course, started floating while he was broadcasting, and he had to abandon the car and it sank. My own car was out of service at first, and then later on when they ran out of cars, they got it back in service. There was one service station, you know, right downtown that was high and dry, and that was Goldpanner.
Right.
And they kept, the National Guard kept dragging cars into there, and they'd put them back together again and send them back out to the water. We like to inject a bit of humor. We always talk about Don. All he did was put up the periscope several times. The old car kept right on running. But we started off with the five, and we ended up with my own car and Steve's car and Jerry's car. So we ended up with three that were still in service after it was all over. And they were located, well, at first they were located everywhere in the city where they could locate without water. Then after a while, they had to move to where the high ground was. The water sort of dictated to where our remote units were going to be. Surprisingly enough, they found eventually that the parking lot of the NC Company right downtown was one of the highest spots, only had about 3 inches of water on it during the high peak of the flood. And they eventually moved from the bridge and from 2nd Avenue and the other areas they were at onto the NC Company parking lot. For one night, they had one car there, and then another car was out by the ACS station, and they did move back and forth by boats and did have a radio in a boat for a while. It's rather jumbled up, really, that parts of that week. I don't recall whether that was Thursday or Friday or Wednesday they did that. And in general, at the high peak of the water, though, they just sort of sat tight. Everybody in one car, if my memory serves me correctly, on the NC parking lot. You know, for a while, when we lost contact with the Weather Bureau, as we did in some other areas, the only, as far as the entire area was concerned, and the public was concerned, and even in some cases, officials of the city, the only area they had to tell whether the water was going up or down was a mark that KFAR's general manager, Don Annan, had put in a building downtown. And everybody was watching that mark, including some of the officials in the area, to find out if the water was still going up or coming down. And, of course, when he said it's going up, 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 so on and so forth, then when he said, I can see the mark again, everybody knew the water was going down, at least for a while, but it was a very slow, gradual moved on, and pretty soon we started broadcasting water going down from that mark on the building. And that's how we did broadcast the entire drama of the water going down, was from that mark on the building.
I see. How do you, say, view your role essentially as a radio station during an emergency like this?
Our role. Do everything you possibly can to help as many people as you can. You forget about the hardcore broadcasting, and you just do what you can. If you have to have it, like we had an announcer who gave typhoid shots. Jerry Springer gave typhoid shots to 300 children out on Badger Road because he was a medic in the Army. I passed out cases of food at the transmitter side. We had young ladies who were taking care of babies that were part of our staff. It was just do anything you could that was needed and announce all the emergencies and things that you had to do. If a fellow came in and he had to have something on the air, you put it on the air. You didn't quibble about it. Sometimes it was difficult to check the authenticity of everything, but we tried to be as careful as we possibly could, you know. Like we had a rat problem at the transmitter, as you probably heard. Mm-hmm. It was a pretty bad problem. One of our engineers' children was quite badly bitten. And we announced that we had them there, and then wondered later on, well, maybe we shouldn't have done that, because we didn't know whether it was a rat problem just where we were at, over the entire hill. We had no way of knowing. But we figured, well, if it is a rat problem around the entire hill, it's better to let them know there's the possibility than to try to keep from panicking people, because in a case like that, so a fella sleeps high and sleeps in his car one night, it would be better to have him do that and have no rat problem anyway than to have a rat problem, sleep on the floor and get bit. So we had to announce that there was the possibility of rat problems. We had nobody else coming in with this information. We just had to sort of take it ourselves, because we had a problem there and we were sort of isolated ourselves.